So it's okay if you make a mistake or if you don't know something. It's all right to say, I don't know, but this is how I will figure the answer out. Or I made a mistake and this is why it's wrong, but let me fix it this way. So it really doesn't matter if you don't know something or you make a mistake. It matters how you move on from that.
All right, so hello everyone, and welcome to the AI Stories podcast. I'm Neil Leiser, I'm a data scientist at Iwoka, and I will be your host. So today, our guest is Jess Ramos. Jess first did a bachelor in maths and Spanish, and then actually did a master in business analytics. She had a couple of experiences, but at some point she joins Form3. She starts as an intern, but climbs the ladder quite fast, and she becomes a data analyst, then a senior data analyst, and finally a manager. Recently, she actually started a new position as a senior data analyst at Crunchbase. But Jess is also quite active on LinkedIn. She has around 40K followers, and she became a LinkedIn instructor, developing a course on analytics. So, really looking forward to this conversation. If you enjoy the episode, subscribe to the AI Stories YouTube channel and leave a 5-star review. All right. Hi, Jess. How are you? How is it going?
Hi, I'm good. I'm super happy to be here. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Great. Everything is fine here. Yeah, very happy to finally find some time to have you on the AI Stories podcast. Really looking forward to this conversation with you. First thing I want to ask is, how did you get into the world of data and AI? How did you get into the field?
Yeah, so when I was in undergrad, I didn't know much about data at all. I didn't even know that data was a field that I could work in. I didn't even see that as an option. So I took an info systems class in undergrad, and that's where I learned just a little bit of basic data analytics, very business heavy stuff. And that's where I was first exposed to data. So I actually reached out to that professor the next semester because I really enjoyed her class, and I asked to do a data analytics directed study with her. And she was actually teaching a data analytics class that next semester, but it didn't fit into my schedule. And I was just so excited to learn. I didn't even need the credits to graduate, and I think she just saw my passion to learn data analytics and learn more. So she agreed to do this directed study with me. So that ended up just being a really great experience. I got a lot of one-on-one time with that professor, and I did a lot of data cleaning and got to work on a project for the college I was at. So that was my first real exposure to data analytics and where I got interested. And that just inspired me to go to grad school for business analytics.
So, what was the project about, your first ever analytics project? What did you do?
So I was working in the enrollment management office, and the enrollment management office basically looks at prospects. So students who are prospects for the college and kind of determining which ones are most likely to enroll. So it was like my first data project ever. So I spent like a ton of time data cleaning, transforming the data set, and just kind of exploring the variables. And I kind of dabbled in modeling a little bit, but looking back, I know those models weren't very good I built because that was a long time ago in my first experience in data. But I was able to at least provide some value to the enrollment management office and find out that females who live in state were more likely to enroll at the college.
Which population did you look at? Like people who were already applying to your school or your college or anyone in the US?
So the data set I had, it was prospects. So these were names that were bought from Nameless. So I think they came from like the SATs and the ACT. So when students go and take those tests, they have to fill out like all of their demographics. So their gender, their the state they live in, the high school they go to. So we had all of these like prospective students, not necessarily ones that applied to the college, but just ones that could be potential prospects. And then we also were able to add in variables too, like to see if the students had applied for the college, if they had phone calls with admissions officers.
And why did you want to predict, like to try and understand who would join the college? Is this because you want to contact them or you want to contact people who might not join but could be interesting for your college? What was the strategy or the idea behind this?
Yeah, so I was working for a manager in the enrollment management office, and the strategy behind it was that we wanted to make sure we were targeting the right students. So we didn't want to waste a bunch of marketing materials and send them to students that were like extremely unlikely to enroll in the college. But we also wanted to make sure that we sent marketing materials to the right students, the ones that would be more likely to enroll. So there was a little bit of marketing involved as well. And it was just important for that department to make sure that they were marketing materials to the right students.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. So you wanted to basically using your analysis for marketing purposes later on.
Yeah. And it was, looking back, it was a little bit of a novice project. Like I can look back and see mistakes I made and how much I've learned since then. But I think that project was so exciting for me because it was my first real data project, and it's where I really fell in love with data.
Yeah, I guess everyone, if I look back to my first machine learning model, I would just cry, I think. But that's how you learn.
Yes, and it's fun to look back too and see how far you've come since then.
Yes, exactly. That's a good point also. Because this was your first project, like which tools did you use and how did you learn those tools? I guess it may be Python or some kind of coding language to process the data. How did you get familiar with this?
Yeah, so I used Excel a lot, and that's how I got good at Excel. So just learning how to kind of clean data, I was learning about recoding variables, so like bucketing them into categories, and also like parsing out strings and splitting by delimiters. I learned a lot of that stuff in Excel, which was super useful. That's where I did most of my data cleaning. They were like Excel sheets from Salesforce, so I didn't use any SQL or anything. For like the actual analysis part, I used R, but I used this like UI interface of R called Rattle. And I'm not sure if it's like still around or even that popular. I've never heard of anyone else using it, but my professor recommended it because it's like a, you know, a click kind of a user face for R, and you can still go grab all the R code on the back end if you want it. But it was really good for me who was learning, getting my feet wet, because I could click and, you know, do everything and not have to do a bunch of hardcore coding. But then at the time too, I was also taking data camp courses in R. So I was kind of getting up to speed with the coding aspect as well.
Okay, so you learn at the same time as you could, I guess, which at the same time as you start the project, basically.
Yes, I was kind of flying. I was like building the plane while flying in.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the best way to learn. Like you learn the basics and then you just get into a project. Don't wait to be an expert and then start a project, because that doesn't make sense. You're never going to be an expert or good enough if you don't actually do something. So that's how I think you learn the best, is by just doing something.
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time Googling, and then every week I would meet with that professor and kind of walk her through like the challenges I was having. And that was helpful as well to kind of hear her perspective after I'd spent a week Googling and beating my head against the wall. But I definitely learned a lot from the experience.
And so this project made you kind of want to go into the field. What did you like so much about data analysis and data science?
I think I liked that there was always a challenge. So every week it was, you know, I would kind of come meet with my professor, talk about what the next step was. And it's like I would fix something and like achieve something. And then we would meet up and then there'd be a new problem to solve. There was something else to do with it. So I just really enjoyed having the constant challenge. And it was exciting to me, just always having a new challenge and something else to do to make it better. And also just kind of trying new things and seeing what happens. So I think that was really cool. And then also the aspect of realizing I started with like this super messy data that wasn't useful at all. And then at the end, I was able to turn that data into useful insights that were able to help my manager out. So just the overall experience of creating something useful out of nothing.
So being challenged and creating something useful, those were the two things that you enjoyed.
Yes, exactly.
All right, so you do this first project, then you do your master in business analytics to get into the field and learn more about it. And then at some point you join Form3. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I went to grad school because I didn't really know exactly what kind of a job I wanted yet. So I kind of went to grad school to like stall for a year and kind of, you know, explore different career options and do some research. And I also knew that I was really excited about analytics and data. So I actually went to grad school because I was just excited to learn more. And it just felt like the right next step for me. And then during the fall of my grad program, Form3, which is a small fintech company in the mortgage industry, they actually opened up a data analyst intern position, like locally in the town I was in school. So I applied for it and started interning. So I interned my whole year of grad school.
You started as an intern, but then you decided to stay.
Yes, I did.
So can we zoom a bit on Form3? Like, first of all, what is the company doing and what was your role there when you started as an intern?
Yeah, so Form3 is a small fintech startup with about 40 people, and it was just a very like welcoming environment, and it was just a really great place to start my career. The product is a software as a service product. So basically, when you go buy a house, you go get a mortgage, you have to get your assets, income, and employment verified. And the lender looks at your assets, income, and employment, and they decide like, yes, we'll give you a mortgage, or no, like you're not approved. So we were a little part of that process. We were a digital verification of assets company. So we were able to pull direct source data from a consumer's bank account and then integrate that into a pretty report and then send it back to the lender. So the lender would receive the asset report and use that to make their decision on the borrower or the consumer. So that's like a background of the company. And I was brand new to fintech. I was new to mortgage. I didn't know anything about the industry. So I was kind of like thrown in, but given a lot of support, of course. And I was just able to learn a lot really quickly about the company and the industry. I started out as an intern and I got to work on a lot of really important projects at the very beginning that stayed at the company, you know, for years and created value for years. And I really just enjoyed that it was a smaller company. I got to impact the company a lot and I just felt very valued. So I ended up staying full time. Luckily, they wanted to hire me full time after my internship. And I was there for almost 3 years total.
Can you zoom into one project that you did during your internship? You mentioned you had, since you joined, you had some impact. So what is some kind of project that you did for Form3?
Yeah, so I would say one of my first projects as an intern, I created a series of dashboards to show our order volumes by integration. So for people that aren't like in the tech scene, integrations are basically companies that use APIs and connect you know, two entities together. So we would have these integrations partners that were integrated with our product, and then the lenders would connect to those integrations. So they were kind of like a middleman between us and our clients. So it was really important for us to track the volumes and the performance of these integrations, because if the integrations aren't performing well, it hurts our revenue. So I actually was able to build out these dashboards to track all of our integrations. So I got to really just work a lot in Power BI. I got to create all these different metrics and tracking logic for our integration partners. And then I visualized it all into dashboards. And those were something that the company still uses today, almost, I guess it's been almost 4 years now. So that was really cool that I got that type of responsibility only like 2 months into my internship. And I was brand new, you know, I still barely knew what I was doing, but my manager was super supportive, and it was just a really good project for me to build some confidence and learn a lot.
So if I understand correctly, like, customers send you their documents because you need to verify them. You process their data, you verify them, or you process the data in a suitable format, and then you send this data to your partners. We will then share it with the lenders. Is that correct?
So almost. So we basically had a workflow, and the consumer would go into the workflow. They would type in their name. So I would say Jess Ramos, and then I would link my bank account. So I would say, I bank at Wells Fargo, and I would go log into my bank account. And just a few easy steps like that, and the borrower's part is done. And then our software takes their information, and we get that direct source data from their bank account, and we put it into a report. And the report is like mostly aggregated, so it shows like how many assets they have and how many bank accounts they linked. And then we're able to send that report to the lender, and then the lender is able to make a credit decision on that borrower. There is a middleman in between us and the lender, the integrations. So the integration is basically the way they connect to our product. It's kind of like confusing. It's a really confusing business model, how all the systems talk together, but the integration partner is kind of a middleman.
And basically the role of those integrations, those partners, is just to connect the lenders with you. Basically, they just connect, and you kind of want to make sure that they connect you with good lenders, I guess, and that you make as much money as possible. Was this the goal of your analysis?
Yeah, pretty much. So lenders can technically connect to us directly, but a lot of lenders don't have those kind of resources because they have to like use APIs and build out systems to connect to us. So a lot of big lenders did build out their own proprietary integrations and connections. But for smaller lenders that don't have those resources, they would use like an already existing integration. So the goal of the dashboards I built was to track those different integrations, because all of the integrations are built just different ways because they're different companies that built them. So sometimes like the workflows can be slightly different or have different messaging. So in a way it does impact the product and the experience a little bit. So the underlying product is the same, but just the way it's kind of built can be either a smoother workflow or a little clunkier. So that's why it was important for us to track those integrations separately, because they do impact our revenue, their performance, and the way that they're built. They impact, you know, our customer experience a lot.
Can you maybe give an example of a decision that would be made based on your dashboard? For example, I don't know, something that you would see on the data and you would be, oh, wow, we need to make this change because I saw this on Jess' dashboard.
Yeah, so I would say a lot of times we would see like a decrease in performance or an increase. So sometimes if we would see an integration just decline really sharply, like the volumes are down, then we might be like, let's dig into that. Let's look at all the clients that are using that integration. And sometimes it would mean that a client, they stopped their service. So they like unsigned up and like left. And that's why volumes are low. Or it could mean that there's a problem with the integration. So if the connections, if something is wrong with the integration connections and the integration breaks, then that's like, you know, the alarm bells are going off. That's something we need to go talk to our tech team about and figure out what's going on with that. And that did happen at times. And the opposite of that is sometimes we would see an integration increase and do really well. So if we would dig into that and see that a client just started using it, then that's good to know too.
Okay, so using your dashboards to monitor the performance of those partners, and then if something unexpected happens, trying to learn from that. And unexpected could be something good or something bad, like a decline in performance or a sharp increase in performance.
Exactly. And if it was, you know, a decrease in performance, then that, you know, the decisions made off of that would kind of depend on what's going on. We would have to dig into it, talk to individual clients using that integration, talk to the integration partners. And a lot of times it would mean that there was a technical issue or like a broken connection. So just being able to track the overall performance of the integrations and the volumes coming through them was just really important to, you know, having a good customer experience.
So do you realize at this point how much impact just a small work like this, or I mean, it could even be big. I don't know how easy it was, but yeah, just one project like this could have. Is that at this point that you really realize that data analysts can have a big impact?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's cool to even see that those dashboards are still being used today at the company, and they've been like tweaked and edited just over time as things change. But the underlying foundation of it is still being used. So it was definitely, it's cool to think that I was a little tiny intern and, you know, my work is still being used today.
One last thing on this internship, because you mentioned you were doing at the same time or just before your master in business analytics. I personally found that master and industry are quite different, but I wanted to have your experience on this. What did you think if you had to compare the master with your internship and your experience in industry later on?
Yeah, they're definitely very different. And it was kind of shocking when I started my internship. I think it was so cool because I was doing them at the same time. So I was able to go to class and learn all this stuff. And then I was able to go see it at my internship and, you know, see the real life version. So I was kind of growing, you know, the formal academic analytics at the same time as my, you know, industry analytics. So I think that was really cool to see the difference between the two. I would say the biggest difference is that in school, you're given like these clean data sets. And that's something I wish that they didn't do as much in school, because when I got to Form Free at my internship, the data was so messy. It was real world data. I was having to deal with like null values and incomplete data, inconsistent data, like real world stuff. And that was something I wasn't used to. And then similarly with the database, in school, we always had a perfect star schema database. We had, you know, a fact table, an orders table, and then we had like a product table coming in, a customer table coming in. It was a perfect star schema data model. And then when I got to the real world, I was like, holy crap, what is all this? Like there were just tables everywhere and it was messy. So I think there's definitely a big difference in the type of data you work with in school versus in the real world.
That's a very good point. I actually had exactly the same experience when you talk about this database. Like I also joined a fintech. That was my first job after uni, and I got all those data sets with all those endpoints and all those different fields. And during your master, sometimes you just even have a single table, right? And you need to build an algorithm based on this table or this data set. But here I had different endpoints, one related to credit assessment, one related to when the user signed up, and I was completely lost. Like, I had to pull the data, join them all together. And that's something that we don't do enough in a master, I think. And it's dealing with the data is actually super challenging, sometimes more difficult than building a model or, yeah, the analysis that follows.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I think in school, they kind of give you training wheels so you can kind of focus on like building the model, building the visualizations, the dashboard. But I found that in the real world, I spend most of my time data wrangling. I'm always cleaning data. I'm in SQL transforming data sets. So I definitely wish that in school we had done a little bit more of like data wrangling and dealing with messy data.
As a data analyst, like obviously we could see from your first project that you can have a lot of impact. I guess one super important thing is the data has to be cleaned, right? It has to show the performance of those partners. And if there is an additional field or if you missed one filter or something like that, it can give you completely different results. So how do you do that to make sure that your data is as clean as possible? What's kind of your approach?
Yeah, so I will say like that integration project I worked on, I did have to deal with a lot of null values. So one issue is that some of our integrations, they weren't logging their unique integrator ID. So we were getting orders coming in with null integrator IDs, which means that we can't tell what integration partner they came from. So when I first started, we weren't tracking the different integrations at all. So part of the work I did was figuring out what integrations that some of the orders came through, even though they had a null integrator ID. So I actually looked at some of the like notification URLs, and I was able to like pull out substrings. So a lot of the integrator ID or a lot of the integrations, they were like passing their name in the notification URLs. So I was able to like extract that and say, if you see this name in the URL, it's this company. So that is like a lot of work that I did on the data cleaning side because I didn't have a complete data set. But that's one example. Usually when I'm kind of assessing a data set, the first thing I look at is the distribution of the variables. I look to see if everything seems feasible. Is there anything super strange? So if I, you know, if I'm looking at a column of gender and I have male and female, and then maybe I have like 52, I have a number, you know, I kind of look for any anomalies and check out the distribution of the variables. I also look at null values and I kind of interpret if it's okay if I have null values or not. Are they nulls or are they zeros? So just looking at kind of the different potential issues in the data and pulling out anything that seems abnormal or incomplete. And when I say pulling out, I don't mean pulling it out of the data set. I meant like identifying, flagging it and, you know, investigating it.
All right. So you load the data, you explore it and identify all those anomalies, so outliers or null values or things that wouldn't make sense. You process it, I guess, and then you have your clean data that you're going to use for monitoring or for another project.
Yes.
So moving on from your internship now, you climbed the ladder quite quickly. You were a data analyst and then a senior data analyst. I'm interested in the senior part. Like, what's the difference between a data analyst and a senior data analyst? How did you make this transition and what was different in your opinion?
Yeah, so my roles were all pretty smooth transitions. It was a smaller company and it's not like, you know, one day I got promoted and my work was completely different. They were all very like, you know, smooth transitioning between the roles. I think that what really made the difference for me is that I got to the point to where I needed an intern. So I had grown so much work and I was creating value for the company. And I was like, I could really use an intern. Like I could get so much more done. It would be so cool to bring someone on and train them. So when I got promoted to a senior data analyst, part of the reason was because we brought on an intern to report to me. And she ended up coming on full time as well at the end of her master's program, which was the same as the one I did. So I think what really separated the senior data analyst and the data analyst role for me was that as a senior, I had someone reporting to me. So I was learning how to delegate work and plan projects a little bit more. And I grew my responsibilities as well. I took on a lot of like higher level work. I was creating metrics for our board meeting and for our capital raise season. I was also creating a weekly report that I would present to the company-wide every week. It just kind of, you know, give a rundown of the state of the business and the highs and lows for the week. So I was just kind of slowly building up all this responsibility and trust within the company. So I think that they felt like it was time for me to get the senior title because of the responsibilities I was taking on.
How did you feel when someone reported to you for the first time? Was this something easy, like a smooth transition, or was it difficult? I know it's not always easy, even just to delegate work. Like sometimes you just feel I should do everything, or I used to do this. So how did you feel about that?
I would say overall, the transition was pretty easy. I had an amazing direct report. I'm still, you know, good friends with her today. I was a very like hands-off kind of a manager. Like I trusted her to do her work, and you know, I knew she'd reach out if she had questions. We'd chat and make sure that, you know, she was getting the help and training that she needed if she was working on something brand new. I think the biggest challenge was probably not delegating enough at first, because especially while she was still in school, I knew that she was in school and, you know, interning part-time with us. I didn't want to drown her in work and just, you know, throw too much at her to where she felt overwhelmed and like, you know, hated working there. I didn't want that at all. So I would kind of give her one project at a time, like, hey, work on this. And, you know, we'd get through that. And then I'd be like, all right, here's your next project. Cause I always had a list of projects to work on at all times. So when she came on full time, I felt like I could delegate a little bit more to her because I knew that her main focus was, you know, her job. She wasn't divided between work and school anymore. But it definitely is hard to learn how to delegate. Even after 2 years, sometimes I would still forget. I'd be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I have to do X, Y, Z. I'm worried I won't finish in time. And she's like, Jess, I can do that. Like, you didn't ask me. I don't mind doing it. And I was like, dang it. You know, like it is hard to remember to delegate and remember that you've helped sometimes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Something I feel can also happen. I saw this sometimes in my company. Someone gets a lot of knowledge because they're here for a long time. And so they know kind of everything. But then every time someone has a question, they would go to this person because this person has all the knowledge. And so if you don't delegate, it's just not productive because you're going to spend your time answering questions when you can actually do real work and be more efficient. So if the person who knows everything delegates a bit of knowledge to everyone in the team, everyone will just be more productive because the junior will have responsibilities and learn something new, and the senior can focus on other things than just answering questions.
Yeah, and that's honestly a really good point. As a manager or someone who has people reporting to them, it is your responsibility to help those people under you grow. Being a manager isn't just bossing people around, getting rid of all your work, telling them what to do, getting stuff done. Like part of being a manager is helping grow other analysts. So it was really important to me to always give this person more challenging work to do. When she first started, I would have her do, you know, some stuff in Excel, a little bit of manual work just to kind of get familiar with our clients and, you know, our business. And I was also giving her additional trainings on our business and product on the side. But then once she kind of, you know, nailed those things down, then I would give her harder things to work on and harder things to work on. And even towards the end, sometimes I would take on the manual task. Like I would do something that was manual and tedious because it would allow her to do something more challenging and grow. So I think part of being a manager is, you know, making sure that the people under you are, you know, getting that business domain knowledge from you and growing themselves as well.
Yeah, very good point, actually. How do you make sure that they keep growing, then that they keep being happy and that they keep, learning more?
Yeah, so I think just always letting them work on new things. So I would try, I mean, sometimes there are things that just have to get done, even if they aren't something new and exciting. Mm-hmm. It might be something manual, but the reality is that it just has to get done. But I would always just try to give her new things to work on. If I had a request that was on like a different data set than she was used to, I'd be like, hey, you take this assignment, and I'd, you know, kind of walk her through, give her a little training on it, and, you know, let her run loose and do what she can with it. So I think just kind of being mindful about the tasks that you're delegating, making sure that you're not always giving that person the exact same thing all the time. Mm-hmm. And then we also had annual reviews, and I would just be really, you know, candid and straight up and ask her. And I felt like we did have an open line of communication. So I would just ask what she enjoyed working on, what she didn't, where she wanted to grow her skill set. And I'd really try to give her opportunities to do that.
Yeah, no, exactly. I kind of agree. I know sometimes where I work, for example, if we need a resource on a project, maybe it's not going to be the most impactful project for the company, but because we know it's going to make this person grow a lot, or in the long term, it's going to be valuable, we can assign them to this project. Obviously, mm-hmm. there are some things that need to be done straight away, and you need to tackle, if you have a project that's going to make the company earn, I don't know, 1 million more per month, you need to put someone on this project. But there's some long-term thing as well. If you give people things that are less important but would be valuable in the long term and make them grow, that's super important.
Yeah, and kind of in addition to what you just said there too, I think sometimes you know that you can do something really quickly and you're like, okay, I've done this before, I can knock this out in one day. But you know that if you train someone brand new to do it and they start it, it might take them 3 days or a little longer. You know, it might not be the most efficient way to get it done for the company, but thinking about the long term, it's better to give that person that learning opportunity. It makes them happier in the long run, gives them more experience, and then you're passing on that knowledge that you have to them. So that way, you know, they're able to answer questions about more challenging things as well.
Yeah, exactly. I saw this quote somewhere. I don't remember where, but the more you grow in a company, the more your success will depend on others. So if you're a manager and you make people reporting to you grow, you will also become more successful because your team is going to do well and you're going to grow even more.
Totally agree. And that's why I don't understand, like, I hear stories about managers out there who don't want the people under them to be successful. Like, it's kind of competitive. They want to take credit for everything and they want all the visibility. And I don't understand that, because personally, I get excited when, you know, if my direct report does something really well, it makes me look good as a manager because I oversaw it all and it makes her feel good. So, you know, I don't understand that kind of competitive vibe. I would rather give them the tools to thrive, and eventually it makes me and my team look good. So that's good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think maybe those people are more thinking about the short term, or I want to get better than them. I need to, keep being the best. But in the long term, I don't think this will be a good improvement. Whereas if you just say, I want, the person reporting to me to be as good as they can, in the long term, it's going to benefit you as well. I like to see this as the more you help people, the more it's gonna help you in the end. Karma exists.
Yes, totally agree.
So let's close the, gonna do a closing, the form-free chapter. And I want to focus now a bit. So actually, you recently left Form3, you joined another company, Freddie Mac, but a couple of months later, you decided to move, and now you're starting at Crunchbase as a senior data analyst. Just a few words on job hunting, because I know you've done this over the past few months. What's your strategy for job hunting? How would you recommend people? What would be your strategy? Let's say I'm a data scientist. I want to look for a new job. What would Jess do if you were in my position?
Yeah, so I will say I've had some job hunting experience this year. I think I learned so much from my first job search, and it really helped me so much more in my second. It's overwhelming and it's hard. And I think going into it, knowing that it's not going to be easy, really helps. I think people kind of go in sometimes thinking, oh, I have a master's in analytics. I have my Google Analytics certificate. People are going to be begging to hire me. And then they're shocked when they get rejected. And I just like to be very raw and transparent, especially through my LinkedIn content. Like, the job search is not easy. I got humbled a lot. I got rejected a lot, and it's normal. So I think just making sure you go in with realistic expectations, I think it really helps. I think too, you just have to be adaptable and learn as you go. So your first few companies you get interviews at, you might not get very far, and that's okay if you don't. So just make sure you learn from every interview. Every interview you go through, you get stronger, you practice your pitch, you practice communicating your value and your experience, and eventually by the end of your job search, you're going to be a pro. You're going to be really good about talking about your experiences and making sure you really deliver your value. So just being realistic and making sure you kind of learn as you go, I think those really help. And then kind of from more of like a how to maximize your interview standpoint, I would say definitely use LinkedIn a lot. So cold applications don't really get you anywhere. So if you're just applying and then disappearing, you're probably going to get very few interviews. It really helps right after you apply to go find someone at that company and get in contact with them. So I recommend reaching out to a few recruiters at the company. If you can, target technical recruiters because they do a lot of the data roles. If you can find the hiring manager, so if you're applying for an analytics role, go find the analytics manager or the director of analytics, someone who's above potentially in the department you're applying for, and just send a LinkedIn message and keep it really brief, show your value, and most importantly, show that you did your research. Show that you're willing to stand out and you did your research on the company. So copying and pasting is not going to be as effective. Make sure you're really doing your research on the company, saying why you're excited about the company, and even building rapport with the person you're messaging. So if they studied the same thing you did in school, maybe point that out, you know? So I think just getting in contact with any person at the company really helps you land interviews. So definitely don't underestimate LinkedIn and outreach in addition to applying.
So do you definitely think that cold messaging people on LinkedIn is much better than just applying through the normal process?
Absolutely. And you don't always get responses. I probably got a response one out of 10 times, and that's okay because it really just takes that one time for it to work to be worth it. So I think just getting in contact with a person helps you stand out, because when you're cold applying, there might be hundreds of people who apply for that position. But when you message someone on LinkedIn, it shows that you're really interested and that you care, you did your research, and it moves your name and your face to the top of the stack. And that's honestly how I landed most of my interviews, through LinkedIn messaging and then also referrals. I've been super active on LinkedIn over the past 6 months. I've made a lot of friends and a lot of connections at really cool companies. So those are the people I used first. I said, hey, like, I know we've been friends on LinkedIn for a few months. I'm interested in your company. Would you mind referring me for this role? And, you know, most people will. So just using those connections and doing anything you can to stand out above just a regular cold application.
Yeah. I think in a company, like when they're hiring you, it's very different from uni, because at uni, they have a class with 100 or 200 students, so they can hire different profiles. But when a company is looking for a data analyst, they're looking for one person, and they want to make sure this person is the right one. So if you just, as you mentioned, copy paste your CV to everyone, you're not going to be able to compete with other people who write targeted CVs or cold messages or things like that. So make sure that you stand out, as you mentioned.
Exactly. And I didn't even talk too much about resumes, but resumes are super important too. So your LinkedIn profile and your resume, make sure you have those really cleaned up. Take out anything unnecessary or not specific to that role. You don't want to have a bunch of fluff and distractions on your resume. And also make sure that you have a lot of numbers on your resume. So show like the number of X that you did, the percent of X that you accomplished. Make sure you show the business impact and the outcomes.
Yeah, I see a lot of friends who are sending me their resume, and they would, one line would be, I did this project where I used Python, I use NumPy, and I'm like, I don't care what you use, like, show numbers. I've made this business earn 10% more per month, or I've improved the accuracy by 50%. Like, I don't care how you get to the solution, but I want to see the impact that you've had.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, hiring managers generally don't care what tools you use. They care about how you impacted the company and created value. So I think one of the hardest parts about not just like your resume and LinkedIn profile, but also interviewing, one of the hardest parts is communicating your value. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to have those numbers, those accomplishments, because it shows how you impacted the company and created value.
What about the more technical part of those interviews? How do you prepare for that? What would be your advice there?
Gosh, we didn't even talk about tech interviews yet. That could be a whole podcast in itself. So I think it really depends on the company. Once you apply to like a lot of places and interview a lot of places, you kind of see like the different types of tech interviews and you get more experience with them that helps. I'd say tech interviews are usually either a take-home assignment or a live coding or like a conceptual interview sometimes I've had. So the take-home assignment, it depends on the company. I would say typically you get a data set with like the company's data and they ask you to solve a problem with it. So which users are most likely to X? Can you create a credit policy based on this data? So there's usually like some sort of a goal, but not a whole lot of information of how to get there. So I think most of the time in my experience, most companies have not really cared what tool you've used. So I've used SQL, Power BI, Python. When I do a take-home assignment, I generally like to show that I can use SQL and Python. Sometimes I'll do some stuff in Power BI if I want to show off my visualization skills. So I think just whatever role you're going for, it's good to kind of do a take-home assignment that will like use the tools that will show that you will be good in that role. So typically the assignments are usually, they take about a few hours. And then sometimes you do a presentation in front of a panel and present on your findings. That's what I did for Crunchbase. So for me, it was like a fun experience. I got to work with Crunchbase data and kind of just see if I liked that type of work. And presenting it in front of all of the data analysts at Crunchbase was also a great experience because I got to see how they asked questions and collaborated. And it was a very friendly environment for me. I didn't feel like I was drilled and being judged. So I think that was useful in my experience. I've also done interviews with live codings. So to prep for those, you really never know what you're going to be asked. So you just have to practice your SQL, make sure you know, CTEs, unions, group by, like all the SQL basics, and sometimes more than the basics, honestly. It just really depends. You don't know what you're going to see exactly. But I think the best way to prep is to practice your SQL and then also collaborate. So ask a lot of questions, like walk through what you're thinking while you're coding. You don't want to just be silent. I think part of a live coding is showing how you can code with someone else and work through a problem.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you communicate what you think, I guess you're going to do much better, because if you don't say anything and you've got bad code or wrong code, the person that's interviewing you will never understand why it's wrong. Whereas if you communicate, you see that you think, you state your assumptions, it might be wrong, but because of one assumption, it might not be a big deal in the end. If you don't say anything, they're not going to value, they're just going to think you're wrong. If you're right, that's fine. But if you're wrong, it's, yeah.
Exactly. And an experience that I had with that at Crunchbase, so I asked for very specific feedback on all of my interviews from the team, and I had a live SQL coding. And I didn't even remember that this happened until I got the feedback. But during my coding, I did make a mistake. I don't even remember what it was at this point, but I made a mistake. And then I like found it and was like, oh, shoot, this is wrong because X, Y, Z. So I found the mistake. I fixed the mistake. And then I also explained why it was a mistake. And that was just, you know, good feedback from the team because they saw that I was able to work through that mistake. And then as a candidate, I thought it was a really good way to see how the team handles mistakes, because they easily could have said, oh, she made a mistake, like she's not good enough to work with us. But instead, they saw the value in me being able to correct it and then explain why it was wrong.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, yeah, that's, communication is always key, and it's often better to over communicate than to not communicate enough. So yeah, make sure you do that. So when we touch on the first part of the interview process, we talked about LinkedIn. I know you're quite active. You've got around 40,000 followers at the moment. What do you think about this platform? Why do you post frequently? What does this bring you as a person and as a data analyst?
Honestly, a lot. So kind of my story with LinkedIn, my quick story, I went viral 6 months ago. I wasn't even a content creator. I used to never use LinkedIn. I would only post if I was starting a new job or if I went to a conference, just very performative surface level things. And then I randomly wrote a post about working remotely. I wasn't trying to go viral. I just randomly decided to write it and post it. And I went viral and I grew 5,000 followers basically overnight. And that's when I found out that people create content on LinkedIn. So I just kind of kept going with it. And, you know, in a short amount of time, I have 40,000 followers, which is crazy. And I can say that my life has changed so much for the better over the last 6 months. I'm not the same person I was 6 months ago. I think just through LinkedIn, I've become way more confident in myself and my story, analytics. I've been able to have a voice in the industry. Like, I can share opinions out there and impact people and learn from others. So I just think it's been really cool to, you know, build my confidence as an analyst and impact people. But I've also learned so much. I've made amazing friends. I've gotten connected with so many people in data science, data analytics, data engineering. I've learned so much about data. Like, it's crazy. Like, my perspective of data has changed because I've learned just so much about it and met different people at different companies. So it really helps to be plugged in with the community. And of course, I have gotten really cool opportunities too from LinkedIn. So being on podcasts, for example, and
yeah,
and being a LinkedIn learning instructor. I'm writing my scripts now, and in a few weeks, I'm flying out to California to film my course. So that's like a crazy awesome opportunity, and I know I wouldn't have it if it weren't for LinkedIn. So I think just like the community and learning aspect are important, but then also it helps you build credibility. It helps you gain visibility. So when you are job searching, you just look, you know, credible on LinkedIn. You have that visibility. So I think it helps. I just love LinkedIn. It helps your career in so many ways. So if anyone's watching this out there and you don't know where to start, it doesn't matter. Just start with something and evolve as you go.
Can you share a bit more about this course on, well, how did you become an instructor, and on a high level, what would be this course about?
Yeah, so they actually reached out to me about it, and I only had like 6,000 followers at the time. So it's not like this, you know, I was like a big content creator or anything. I posted about needing more women in the field. And, you know, one big thing about me is that I like to support women in STEM and women in data. And they saw that post and thought it was inspiring. They thought that I was doing a good thing by building community and, you know, a safe space for women in data. And I think they just saw that that was a good fit for kind of what they were doing with LinkedIn Learning. So they reached out to me and asked if I'd be interested. And I was like, there's no way this is real. So I like, you know, learn more about it. And I was like, this is so cool. So it's just been crazy. Like, I've been working on my course, developing all of my videos. Right now, I'm working on writing scripts. So it's just been really fun. My course is going to be, it's going to be tailored towards newer people in analytics and early career analysts. So I kind of imagine people who are still in school, or maybe people that want to transition from another career. It's basically going to be a course for them to decide if they want to work in analytics, and if so, how they can get there. So it's going to kind of give like a roadmap of these are the things that you really need to learn, and kind of maximizing your journey of learning analytics and landing that first job.
Great. Looks really cool. Let us know when the course is out. I guess I will see it on LinkedIn since we're connected.
It'll be early 2023. There's not like an official date yet. I am filming in December. So I don't know how long it'll take them to like edit and like put everything together, but it will definitely be posted on LinkedIn when it's ready. So super excited.
Amazing. Looking forward to it. Just want to ask two final questions on your career before we finish the episode. The first one is, looking back at everything you've already done, if you had to do one thing differently when you started, what would you have done?
So honestly, I don't really believe in having regrets. I think that everything I did was for a reason and got me where I am today. I think even like the mistakes I made, I think those helped develop and shape me. So I really don't think that I would change anything if I could go back. But if I had to choose something, I would say that I wish I was more confident in the beginning and believed in myself more. I was terrified to learn how to code. I didn't think I was smart enough. I didn't think I would be good at it. I also was scared to be myself. Being a woman who majored in math and then working as an analyst in fintech, you know, sometimes I'm one of the only females around. So I think I was scared to be too girly or too feminine, too bold. So I think I really compressed myself. Oppressed. I don't know what word I'm thinking of, but I kind of like didn't be my full self. I was scared to be myself because I thought that
restricted yourself.
Yes. Like I restricted myself. I like, you know, reeled myself in and didn't be my full self. So I think just, you know, be yourself and don't be scared to just show everybody who you really are. And I think that's part of the, you know, part of what I've really learned through all this LinkedIn stuff. I have been able to be myself and I love it. Like, I love being able to encourage other women and let them know that you can be yourself, you can be feminine, but also be smart and be a data analyst.
If you had one advice for someone to progress in their career, just one advice, what would it be?
One advice. Oh, I have so many things I want to say. I would say one advice. I would say don't be scared to make mistakes or not know something. I think school really trains you to be right or wrong. You're worried about what grade you're going to get. In the real world, you're going to be wrong and it's okay. So it's okay if you make a mistake or if you don't know something. It's all right to say, I don't know, but this is how I will figure the answer out. Or I made a mistake and this is why it's wrong, but let me fix it this way. So it really doesn't matter if you don't know something or you make a mistake. It matters how you move on from that. And I think a lot of people are so scared to start their career in analytics and learn how to code and be a data analyst because they're scared they are going to mess up or they won't know how to do something. And I'm here to say that you're definitely going to mess up and there are going to be things that you don't know how to do. And that's okay. I think that's part of the fun of the career.
Definitely agree with that. And I actually want to share, I guess, two stories based on that. The first one is when I was doing interview for the first time, you know, sometimes you have a bunch of questions in home assignments. And there are some questions I didn't know. And because in school, you just have grades. And if you just put something wrong, you're not going to be marked down most of the time. So I was just trying to answer every possible questions. And I don't think that's the right thing to do. You, in industry, when you work, if there's something you don't know, don't bullshit or don't make it up. Just say, I don't know, but I'm going to look it up and I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to come back to you with the answer. And that's something that school doesn't really teach us. You, like, it's fine to be wrong and it's fine to say, I don't know. And it's fine to say, I don't have the answer right now. I'm going to find it later. And so I think that's a super good point that you bring. The second point is on mistakes. And I also really agree. I think you actually learn much more from your mistakes than from things you do well. It's only when you do big mistakes that you really get hit, but you learn a lot. And after that, you usually become much better.
Totally agree. I think what you said about don't bullshit if you don't know is super important because you don't want to bullshit and, you know, impact your company in a bad way. I think it's way better to say, I don't know. Let me find out. Let me go learn. Let me look into it than to just make something up. So totally agree there. And the making mistakes part, I think it really helps when you have, you know, a supportive team. It's good if you have teammates you can rely on. You can do a sanity check and say, hey, look at my code. Does this sound right to you? And when you do have that safe, collaborative environment, you can help each other through things and, you know, kind of be a devil's advocate. And, you know, it really does help you produce the best results and get good feedback.
Yeah, I think you need to find the right balance between, obviously, you need to ask for feedback and you need to, well, not just release something, you know, without any review or things like that. If it's an analysis that's important, you want someone to review your work. On the other hand, you also need to take responsibilities and don't be scared to make mistakes, you know, and ask for 10 reviews because there might be a mistake in your code. Like, you need to take responsibilities and know that some of the time you're going to be wrong. If you just hold yourself and try to be right all the time, you're not going to progress fast because you're just going to do things that you're comfortable with and you're going to progress much more slowly than someone who is not afraid of failing.
Very true. I think that balance is important. And I think it comes with building confidence in yourself.
Well, Jess, thanks a lot. It was amazing to have you here on the show. Have a great day. And yeah, hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was so much fun. Thank you for having me, and I'll see you around.